Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun, the podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson. Yes, they've decided to keep going with me. At about the 50 podcast mark, 50 episode mark, the people at Nerdist were thinking, he's terrible, what are we going to do? And they were thinking, yeah, of replacing me, but they already had the logo and everything, had my name in it, Tom Wilson, and they couldn't find another one. There are many other Tom Wilsons, but they couldn't find one, I guess, quickly enough, so they stuck with me. There have been a lot of Tom Wilsons that I've known, and I'm a member of the Thomas Wilson Society, which is based in England, and all the Tom Wilsons of the world, well, not everyone, but a lot of Tom Wilsons are members of this society. And there was a Thomas F. Wilson, which is my middle initial. There was a Thomas F. Wilson when I was at college, and it caused great problems for the administration or the office worker people. And no matter what I did, no matter how much I begged, they would not exchange my academic record, my GPA, for the other Thomas F. Wilsons. And believe me, I begged. Thank you, Jeff Harlan, for just doing the Big Pop Fun. I had Jeff do that, and that's the intro music that I put together myself with my own guitar and my own little voice. But people have been writing me and saying we can't hear Jeff's voice on the intro. And as you know, I am a stickler for audio technology. I'm not. I don't know what I'm doing. But I put every episode of the podcast through a program called Levelator, which adjusts levels and everything. But I'm not sure. I'm doing it wrong with the intro with Jeff's voice and maybe the outro too. But so I don't know how to do it. So I'm trying to figure it out to be better. But I must admit, because I'm honest with you, a wonderful listener to the podcast, if you've listened at all, you know I don't really pay close attention to the technological aspects of this. I just turn on this little box, talk into it, and then we go, right? Because we're all just friends here, and Tom is just saying, hey, I talk into things, and some people listen, and I appreciate that. Welcome back to Big Pop Fun. Welcome back to a magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we zoom across the rocky terrain of our pasts, of our failures, our disappointments, our all too faulty and frail humanity. And we decide together that, without failure and disappointment, there wouldn't be compassion. Compassion wouldn't exist without our failures, without our great disappointments, without our knowledge of our frailty. And without compassion, we would only have plastic, empty success and worked up fake compassion. And, that would make life into a poor copy of television. And we can't have that, can we? We live real lives here at Big Pop Fun. So warm up your earbuds, folks, and listen to a human being talk to another human being. And I hope it inspires you to eventually, not right now, but eventually at the end of the podcast, to take out those earbuds and talk to another human being yourself. The podcast is always brought to you by art. Please support artists wherever you are. You know what? Good news. I have been telling you about the bigpopfun.com website where, as I've said, my paintings are on sale, and they've been slashed by about half because of the loss of art galleries, unfortunately, throughout the country. So, and people have gone on to bigpopfun.com, and they have purchased paintings, which I hope are really give them a lot of joy in their life. Put it on the wall. That's stuff that I made, and I appreciate your supporting art. Like I say, support the arts by buying art from people. Go to a show, go to a concert, tell the people you enjoyed it, and I hope you have fun with the arts as we become more and more connected to our remote control and our refrigerator. And not that I'm not. Hey, people, I am too, but I have to myself. support artists, and get out there. It's also brought to you by my book, The Masked Man. It's still by Tom Wilson. I still use Tom Wilson on the book. People are enjoying it. It's available for iPad and Kindle and Nook and all kinds of e-readers. Or I'm thinking about a way on eBay to auction off my coming to your house and reading it to you personally. So thanks. As I've told you, if you listen to the podcast at all, I came to California and went right to work at the Comedy Store, the gigantic black monolith of concrete there on Sunset Boulevard, right on the Sunset Strip. And I'm not sure if it was the very first night, but very early on in my time there, I met a very vitally important figure in my growth as a comedian and a person, my friend Blake Clark, who was a doorman there and a comedian of very rare and very high talent. If you haven't listened to my conversations with Blake, he is on the podcast on several episodes. We had a wonderful conversation that I hope we continue. I hope we do a couple more episodes and talk to him about various other things. But Blake was a great older brother figure to me when I was new in Los Angeles, and I was new to show business. I was new to this experience of just grabbing a microphone and getting on stage and just saying things that occurred to me, making up jokes, making up songs, performing skits. And he'd been doing it for a little while and was a person of much more experience and gritty and difficult experience as well. And Blake was married and had a son. And Travis Clark was one of my earliest little buddies at the Comedy Store. Because, of course, back east near my family and everything, I knew little kids and families and everything. And in Los Angeles, just seeing a family, a man and his wife and a son and a little baby son, Nicholas, I didn't see that very much. So the Clarks were very important to me. And Travis was always a great presence at the Comedy Store. Blake's kid, who was a little kid, he wasn't that young. I mean, he was a little kid, and he would run around the Comedy Store and back in that time when you could put your kid in the back of the room and give him a free Coke and let him have fun at daddy's work. So Travis came around, and Travis and I were buddies, and incredibly to me, that with Travis's experience of show business, of stand-up comedy, as he certainly had for so many years growing up, he decided to go into it himself. And I remember hearing from Blake when Travis went through high school, Notre Dame High School here in Los Angeles, and he decided to go to Carnegie Mellon University there in Pittsburgh and study theater. And I thought, wow, sheesh. Little kid that ran around the Comedy Store is going to have actually more classical acting training than me. But that he did. He went off to college, and now he is a young comedian with a very unique perspective. He's got his own podcast called Tiny Odd Conversations, TOC, a podcast. And I really enjoyed talking with him. Went over to his house in North Hollywood. And anyway, we had a lot of fun. I hope you enjoy my conversation with my old buddy from the time he was a little kid, Travis Clark.
It's Big Pop Fun.
We have Travis Clark here on the Big Pop Fun podcast. You have such professional equipment. I'm actually trying to be a radio announcer.
Well, I'm just making up for my lack of listeners. It's just
really.
Yeah, you go.
Travis Clark is here, the host of Tiny Odd Conversations podcast. But my good friend, since you were knee high to a grasshopper.
Oh my gosh, 5 or 6. Yeah, like a little.
You were
kid.
a little kid.
Because everybody knows little kids hang out at the ticket booth at the Comedy Store.
At the Comedy Store.
That is just where you will find children 24/7.
You and Pauly Shore.
Yeah.
Who
was 7 years older than me, because he was 14 when I was 7. And our joke, if you can call it that, was that, oh, combined we're 21, so we can go in together. That was our joke we came up with together.
Pauly's that much older than you, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I remember Pauly, maybe when I met him when he was, I don't know. 10 or 12 or something.
You meet a...
But when you were 5, you were bigger than him.
That's true. Yeah.
You could take Pauly Shore when you were 5. Problem.
Yeah.
And you didn't sweat Pauly Shore.
Yeah. Why would I? You know, interesting about Pauly Shore and semi-interesting about me, at one point, Doogie Howser, I went to Network to be Doogie Howser, and Pauly Shore went to Network to be the friend. So
really?
It could have been a totally different show. Totally different show if they'd have gone with that direction.
Thank God for Neil Patrick Harris.
I'm going to agree with you on that, yes.
Man, we would have never seen such the Rent. We never would have seen him. The Sondheim work he's done. All the beautiful, beautiful musical theater.
And we'll never know how he met your mother or what... I know that's a show he's on. I don't know whose mother they're meeting. I'm assuming it's his.
So Travis Clark, as I will, I suppose I'll do it in the introduction that you're the son of Blake Clark, that one of my very good friends, best man at my wedding, and a guest on the Big Pop Fun podcast for many episodes, which are interesting to me. They're just like seminal Big Pop Fun podcasts that people contact me in order to say, oh, I love your podcast, listen to it a lot. But those episodes with Blake were really unbelievable. So people have collected them on their phones or their pods or whatever, and they listen to them a lot. And which I've tried to tell your dad, and he says, nobody cares.
Nobody gives a crap what I talk about.
But here's what I wanted to talk to you about early. And we always ask, hey, what'd your dad do or where are you from and everything? And I kind of know for the first time. So in my life, my dad, I'll try to make it short, but my dad, his dad had abandoned their family when he was very young, when he was 5 or 6 years old, during the Depression. The Depression came, and he left the family. My dad was put into an orphanage, and things were very difficult, and was raised in a very, very tough time, in great poverty, and with a great deal of, I guess, anger about his dad and everything.
Sure.
And but here's the thing. My dad had some, you know, upsetting things that had happened to him in his life. So when we were kids, not that he was angry about it, or, I don't want to talk about that or whatever, but there was sort of an aura of kryptonite about my dad's past.
Sure.
That we didn't go there.
Right.
Because he didn't talk about it. I had one grandfather whom I loved, but the other one I just didn't have.
Right.
And we didn't know why that was. And maybe when I was very young, I had asked. But we just kind of left it alone. So by the time I was probably in my mid-20s, maybe even, by the time you say, hey, Dad, like, what's the deal with that? Like, what happened? And he says, well, you know, my father worked this... he was kind of a ne'er-do-well. He had this candy store, but it was a front for a gambling operation in the back. And, you know, and I used to bottle liquor in the basement that he would sell.
At 5?
Younger than 5, down in the basement, like learning to bottle a bottle beer or liquor that he would smuggle and everything, that kind of stuff. My question to you is, when you're a kid, and not that your dad had a very, very different experience, of course, than that. But when there's a big thing that had happened to your dad and you were young, were you really open about it with your dad? I mean, did you ask him questions about that? Or was that kind of surrounded in a thing that you just kind of left alone? Because before I let you answer, and I'm interrupting you, I apologize, but your dad was talking about it a lot, like publicly and on The Tonight Show. If people haven't listened to the Blake podcast, you know, a Vietnam veteran, as he joked about front lines, bang, bang, as deep and wounding and incredible as an experience in a war could be that your dad experienced. So what was your approach when you were a kid with that stuff that he's doing on The Tonight Show?
Well, you know, I knew from an early age that my dad was a Vietnam vet. Like, I knew that, I knew those words. I don't think I knew what it meant till I was a bit older. Like, I knew, oh, it meant he was in the military. Because at like 5 or 6, I think, you know, you're still playing Army. Like you think, oh, that must be fun. Like it's not something you think of as something that changes your perspective on life, mm-hmm. you know? And I knew that he did jokes about it, and I knew that people found it funny because I would see people laugh at the, you know, but a lot of his jokes were like what it was like to encounter the drill instructor, you know, stuff that you see in films and stuff. So mm-hmm. I, as I got older, it wasn't until, well, there's a lot of things. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that he was open about with me if I asked him. But then as I got older, I was like, I mean, there's part of me that is curious. There's part of me that goes, want to understand my father better and understand his experiences. The other part, it goes, well, is this something I'm allowed to ask about? Like, I don't want to dig up the horrors of war and have you talk about stuff that you don't want to talk about. But I remember, I think it was when I was about 18 years old. I don't know, I was 18. So I was full of being 18, and he asked me to do something, and I gave him some smart ass answer. And then it occurred to me, like, my dad has killed people. Like, I probably shouldn't be mouthing off to this guy. Like, this man has taken lives for a living. Like, not like, for a couple years of his life, that was his job, was to go to a foreign country and to eliminate people he was told were an enemy. And that is something that you go, oh, like, that's pretty heavy. That's pretty serious. And he has told me, some really, I think he keeps the really haunting stuff to himself to mm-hmm. not bring it out on other people. But he's told me story. I mean, he told me, I hope he doesn't mind me repeating.
We don't have
stuff.
To. Travis,
no, I mean, I'm fine. He told me the story of the first time he ever shot somebody. Mm-hmm. And I remember being really, and I was a teenager. I was probably 14, 15. And just one of the, like, it wasn't like, hey, dad, so tell me about murdering. Like, it was, we were just having a father-son moment. We were just talking. We were talking about life, talking about different things. And he said, you know, I was in the military and I was out. We were out. We weren't even out looking for somebody. He was out walking and I'm trying to remember the story right, but I remember he tripped. He was walking with his men. He was a lieutenant in the Army, so he was in charge of the other guys. So he's leading his platoon, and he trips, and they said there was like a dead branch or a big piece of grass stuck in the ground. And he said, I had to turn my head or it would have gone in my eye. So I had to turn my head to avoid basically poking my eye out. And on the distance, he saw a Viet Cong soldier far off on a hill, just because he had to turn his head without. So the guy was not noticing that there was a platoon of U.S. soldiers there. And so my dad took him out, and he said, for a long time, I denied it to my men because I was embarrassed. I was like, I shot this guy on the side of a hill for the reason that I was told to, like, if you see one of these guys, you shoot him. And I just remember, you know, your dad is, at least to me, what is kind of a hero when you're a kid, you know, like he's Superman, he's whatever your version of Mr. Tough Guy is. And then as you get older, you're like, oh, you're just a person. And you find, you know, and he has this incredible experience that he learned that, you know, that's what's still crazy to me is I think about at 24, I was, gotten kicked out of acting school and was like, oh, my life's over. At 24, my dad was in Vietnam fighting for the country and going through. And you go, I should probably never complain about things around mm-hmm. my dad. Like, that's just a whole different level of responsibility. Like, being responsible for other people's lives, being responsible for having to take lives. Like, that's something I can't imagine. That's something I can't put my head around.
But it's interesting to me in real maturity, which is where you, like you talked about, you find out that your dad really is just a human being, mm-hmm. struggling and questioning just like everybody, but in so many ways, overcoming those fears or doing that stuff. And it turns out to be a deeper, better admiration than the hero worship when you were a little kid.
I'd agree with you. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's not rooted in fantasy. It's rooted in reality. It has this, oh, this is who you are as a person. You're not just the guy who, you know, protects me and puts food on the table. There's more to you than that. You're not just the guy who, you know, and my dad's dad, would have been my grandfather, died when my dad was either 12 or 13. So my dad has said to me as I've gotten older, he's like, I didn't know how to be a dad. I didn't have a dad after 12. I didn't know what to do. And I mean, was your dad like that? I mean, did he have the ability to be a, did he have a father figure after he?
He did.
Yeah.
He did. He had a man who he was, well, very different certainly than your dad, but he had a man who was a mentor figure to him because he got out of school and was, you know, he was from the other side of the tracks. He had no money. When he graduated from, the smart kids would be sent to a high school. The kids that they judged weren't ready for that kind of high school, you would go to a trade school and something like that. But the orphanage would send you to a high school. So he went through the high school, did well. But at graduation from high school, you got a $1 bill and a rosary.
Wow.
In a box, because that's all they had. You know, the nuns would give you a rosary and $1 and the best of luck to you.
And God bless. Have at it.
So he was out working, and he was good with words and things like that, and had skills. So he got a job as a secretary.
Okay.
Literally dictation, that kind of stuff, and filing. And after a while, this lawyer, a man named Marcel Vitti in Philadelphia, said, you know, you got a lot on the ball. I mean, you could be a lawyer if you wanted. And he's, well, I, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to be a lawyer because I got nothing. And the man got him through college, went to the University of Pennsylvania, put him through law school, and said, you work for me. You can go to school at night and you can be a lawyer. And he became a lawyer.
Wow.
With this man's help and mentoring. And that was, of course, a terrific thing.
That's great. I mean, I wish there were more stories like that. Like, I feel you don't.
I think there are. I think that people are interested in them, maybe in a light way, on a website or on Facebook. You read it, you click like, and then you move on.
And then you want to see, yeah.
And then you want to see an accident.
Right. Or a cat with a.
Oh, you like that? Watch this kid get hit by a car.
Right.
And so, you know, I think we're sort of disconnected from that. But I would think, I'm only assuming now, but that there are stories like that everywhere. Everywhere.
Yeah, I guess so. And it's
of
also
great kindness, of those small, the small miraculous thing of a person who's really extending themselves toward another person to help them.
But it is pretty funny to see a kid get hit by a car.
You got to admit.
Yeah.
I love. No, we don't have to talk about dad, of course, the whole time.
No,
to remember which moved me, and I still remember. And you may forget this, but he told me he came to work, you know, not deeply upset, but troubled because he was at the mall with you, and you were little, and you actually, in a sense, took care of him.
Oh, yes.
Because I remember someone had been hit.
Yeah.
And camouflage was big.
Mm-hmm.
Camouflage was very fashionable. So every kid was wearing like camouflage pants and a camouflage jacket, and combat boots were all big. And I won't remember it perfectly, but you came out of the mall and a kid had been hit by a car.
No, what had happened was, and this isn't even a mall anymore. I think I think it's one shop now, but it used to be this big place called the Fashion Plaza. I think it was. It's
mm-hmm.
It's in North Hollywood in California, and there was this huge parking lot, and the Orange Julius, the end of every mall, had this big window that you could look out and see the parking lot, and the cops are chasing some guy. And he has camouflage pants on, but I don't think he had a shirt on. And he's just running like it's just a foot chase with cops. And the cops shoot the guy, just shoot him in the back. And he falls down. And there's blood. I mean, I can't remember it perfectly because I just remember being like, I just saw a guy getting shot
right.
at six. Like, this right. is a little much. But my dad started having what's, you know, best described as a flashback.
Right.
You know, where it's to hear him tell it later, it was like all of a sudden he was back in Vietnam. This guy who got shot was in his platoon. Sure. There were helicopters. There was no mall. They were out in a field, you know. Suddenly it's a scene from Platoon, you know, mm-hmm, it's not Orange Julius in an ice skating rink. That's gone.
Right.
And, I remember being freaked out, and then I just feel like my hand hurts a lot because I'm holding my dad's hand and he's just squeezing it and kind of shaking a little bit. And I was like, okay, Dad, let's go back to the car. Hey, why don't we go home? And yeah, I mean, in that case, I kind of had to, I knew enough to like, we should go. We should probably go home, you know.
But I remember your dad being moved and telling me about you taking care of him, about how small you were, but having that presence of mind, like, okay, Dad, let's go. Easy, big fella.
You know what? I don't need an X-Wing toy that bad. We can skip the toy store. Why don't we go home? Why don't we get you some ice cream? Just get him out of there. And it's weird, like, I remember that happening, yet at the same time, it's almost like, oh, that's that movie I watched.
Isn't that interesting, Travis, that happens with so many people. It happens with me, with these incredible things. With the I tell a story on the podcast previously about a guy flying a kite. And I went up to him, and it was the guy who was having such joy flying the kite that he was shouting and singing. And I went up to him, and he turned to me and didn't have eyes. He was completely blind, and he was flying a kite, and the kite crashed, and he followed the wires of the kite all the way to the kite to set it up correctly again, followed the wires all the way back, and then pulled it up and started flying the kite again and shouting and just reveling in this kite that he couldn't see. As you not that I've told the story all the time, oh, it's the guy with the kite story, but it's so true. As you tell a story that you know in the marrow of your bones is true, it becomes this story.
Yeah. It takes on a cinematic quality where you're like, okay, and we start off with the sweeping shot. You see the people walk. You know, like, mm-hmm. I feel like it's it just becomes this. Not that story that I was telling is a defining moment in my life, but it's definitely something that, I mean, it was the first time I ever saw a guy get shot.
Right.
And the first time I can remember ever being like, oh, I should get my dad some, you know, where you, the roles aren't really reversed because I'm not old enough to know how to take care of somebody,
right.
But I'm old enough to know I need to do something, you know?
Yeah. But that came out of your heart, not your brain.
Right. Yeah.
To take care of your dad.
And I
have not seen anybody get shot.
Really?
And yeah, and when I'm running from the cops, I don't have a good view of them from behind me, so I don't see the whole chase like the thing. I'm just going forward pretty much.
It's still one of those things that, I mean, this if it were like a big case, like something that there was a big news story about, I'd be like, "What did that I still don't know what that guy did. I just know I saw a guy running and then get shot." Like I've seen people run from police before. They get tackled.
It's L.A. Yeah. They ticked them off. They just ticked them off. Bad day for them.
It's if you've not seen a man get shot, I'd avoid it. It's not great. It's not a lot of fun. I didn't walk away going like, yeah, the movie's got it right. That's totally how it is. That's great. Like I remember being kind of disturbed by it for like a while. I mean, especially at six, you shouldn't see anyone get shot for real. Right. But it's, yeah.
Isn't it weird that the fascination with it though?
Yeah.
That people do actually have, because, you know, because we are, you as a person, your dad was in Vietnam, and people probably all the times are like, what happens when you shoot someone? Like, what do you do? What happens? I think as an actor, I asked your dad that, you know, 25 years ago, probably just to, you know, just for my, you know, junior actor, I'm going to know how things happen, you know, or what happens to you. And that just to put it in your filing cabinet of reactions. So mine will be really real.
I think I've asked him that question too. And I think his answer was they die, you know, like, and that's, right. You know, it's, you go, oh, right. Cause not everybody sits there and does the, like the wiggle with squid packs going off and fake blood going everywhere. Like, no, they just fall over and they don't live anymore. Like, it's,
yeah.
Good times. Good times.
Good times. So from that, from Dad's experiences and watching Dad in show business and acting in so many things, what was the seed planted within you from external sources, from watching Dad? Or did something happen in school where you in a show and really thought, boy, I know Dad does this and I've seen this a lot, but boy, you know, it is fun. There's something about this.
I guess it's a combination of the two. Like I remember, I mean, getting to grow up around comedy and getting to go to sets with my dad when he was working on stuff, I was like, well, this seems like fun. This seems like you don't have to grow up, and it just seems like you get good at this and you just work, which is not what happens. You know, it's not coal mining, but it's a lot of work and it's a lot of BS you got to put up with. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, I did do plays in school, but going back to elementary school and I felt I had a natural ability for it.
So it was kind of within your skill set, which was how you gravitated toward it.
I thought so. But then for a long time, I didn't want to do stand-up comedy because I'm like, well, that's my dad's thing.
Yeah. And then I also think that it's the Knight Rider hat that I gave you when I was on Knight Rider. Have to mention. Well, you know, I'll skip over it, but it was given to me by David Hasselhoff.
That was and would still be one of my treasured artifacts if it had not disintegrated. It literally fell apart maybe 5 years ago. Like, I had it up until 5-ish years ago.
I guess it was the early 80s, an early acting job that I got was on Knight Rider chasing around David Hasselhoff. They gave me this baseball cap. It's kind of trucker hat, yeah, Knight Rider, black, and everything. Oh. I cannot, hats are impossible with me because I've got a huge head. And I'm thinking, well, who would like this? Oh, you know, Travis Clark, little kid, he'd like a hat.
Whose favorite show was Knight Rider?
Yeah, like, from Michael Knight and everything. Yeah, so I give it to Blake, and, you know, he takes it home, and he comes back and, hey, man, Travis loves that hat. Wow. I don't think he's taking it off to sleep yet.
So I was
just happy that you liked it.
Oh, I love that hat. So, like, it's one of those things now that was, it was probably cool for something in the 80s, but now if you're like, check out my Knight Rider trucker hat from like 83 or whenever that was, like, now I just feel like that's got so much geek street cred to it.
Right,
now. Like, it
right.
would just be, but literally whatever cardboard or plastic that was in the bill turned to powder.
Yeah.
And then the hat just kind of collapsed in on itself. I don't know. I don't know what they made.
Sort of
it
like
out
David
of.
Hasselhoff himself.
A little
think.
Bit.
Maybe.
A little bit.
I don't know. Just sort of turned to powder and begin crumpling.
Yeah, it might.
I'm
have been.
Kidding, David. I see David sometimes. Once in a blue moon, I see him at my Costco.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't know why, but my
Hoff goes to Costco.
The Hoff goes to Costco. Believe me. Trust me on this one. The Hoff goes to Costco, and my character name on the Knight Rider episode, not the big movie that I did after. No, on the Knight Rider episode, my character was named Chip. If David Hasselhoff sees me at Costco, he goes, hey, Chip.
Wouldn't it be great if David Hasselhoff is just kind of in this state of Knight Rider was real. Like, I'm just going to refer to you as everybody that you were on that show. No,
David he's a nice guy. Has a good sense of humor about himself. And
I heard a story about it. I don't know if it's true, so I should probably tell it.
Yeah, of course.
That at one of his low points post Knight Rider, pre Baywatch, everybody knows the whole thing that he's big in Germany.
Yes.
So he had a semi music career going in Germany, but to kind of capitalize on some post Knight Rider fame, his low point was like wearing this piano scarf and sitting in the T-top of a, what was that? A Firebird? Whatever Knight Rider was.
Was it a Trans Am?
It was a Trans Am. Sitting on like the sunroof or the T-top of a Trans Am playing guitar and singing songs in like some parade in Germany and being like, this is probably not going to end well.
Wow.
You know, but at the same time.
Thank God no one has video of my doing that in the Ukraine. Singing the Power of Love for a Ukrainian roller derby festival. No, I didn't do that.
Oh, oh hey, I was so maybe wanted to know more about that. I was like, wait, what?
Hey, maybe you made up yours. We don't know if that's true. So I was making up one.
Oh.
But what I do remember is now you were very serious about pursuing an acting career.
Oh, yeah.
And through high school, where'd you go, Notre Dame?
I went to Notre Dame here in
Sherman Oaks, California. Yeah.
Then I went to Carnegie Mellon University.
I know that's what I'm saying. Yeah. When I talked to Blake, I said, what's Travis up to? Well, he's going to Carnegie Mellon for theater. I'm like, whoa, Mr. Fancy Pants acting. Because that's quite a serious theater school.
You know what they don't like at that school? If you take stage blood and write Helter Skelter all in the main theater and light the curtains on fire, they don't think that's as funny as 17-year-old me.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't think that was as hilarious as I did.
So was your time at Carnegie Mellon very brief?
I went there for a year and a half.
And how did you find it? When you get there and you know, were you pursuing a classical training to have a career in the theater?
In as much as 17, 18-year-old me could be serious about something, which turns out was not a lot, yes, I was. I don't know. If I'm honest, I don't know what I thought would happen after I graduated. I don't think I had plans to go to Broadway, but I guess I thought, oh, I'll do this. And a lot of great actors have come out of this school. So then
I'll learn how to do that. Whatever they teach here. Yeah.
And I did learn some stuff there. I met amazing friends. I met amazing people that I still am in touch with today.
Did you learn stuff about acting?
As much as I could. You know, I honestly wish I could have gone to that school at like 20, because I had a lot of growing up to do. I was incredibly immature. I was incredibly moody. And I just was, I wasn't ready to take something seriously. And if you're going to be spending $25,000 a year to learn to be an actor, you should take it seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, you should really apply yourself. Whereas I was like, oh, I'm going to read the lyrics to this like really silly song for my dramatic interpretation because I'll show them this is all crap, you know?
Right.
Well, then why are you doing it? You know, why? Yeah. And I wasn't kicked out of the school. They basically said, yeah, why don't you go grow up a little bit and come back? And I went, well, why don't you? You know, and so,
right.
And then I didn't go back. But
so did you really write Helter Skelter and Fake Blood?
Yeah, well, we were doing Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, okay.
And I had a lot of free time in between my sword fight.
Yeah.
And I would just go and write like what I thought was funny in stage blood, because I was also, fun fact about theater school, yeah, they let you do stage stuff, but they also want you to be the crew. So I had to watch.
It's like being an intern at a medical school.
Yeah.
It's like, welcome. We'll teach you something about acting, but you're not really going to act for years.
Yeah.
You're just going to carry props. You're going to make costumes. You're going to do lighting.
Yeah, that's a lot of what we did. So I had this sword fight in the very beginning of the thing, and then I had a scene at the end. And in between, I had a lot of time to do whatever and to set up other stuff. And fun fact, had to wash cod pieces after the show was over. That was my job. Gabe Mocht, the star of White Collar on USA Network, I washed his cod piece for 2 months. Like, we love to see Gabe again.
Yeah.
Good-looking guy. But I knew if I wrote Helter Skelter on the wall, I was going to be the one there till 2 a.m. washing cod pieces. I'd have time to clean it up.
Yes.
But, you know, it turns out a lot of people who want to study theater are very dramatic. So a lot of people are like, I was so offended by the Helter Skelter. And I went, it was fine, you know. So I got in trouble. I got told to leave. But in hindsight, probably better for the university and better for me. So it all worked out in the end, I think. Because then I ended up coming back home to Los Angeles. Like, I still am not entirely sure my thought process, where I was like, oh, I live in Los Angeles. Why don't I move to Pittsburgh for 4 years if I were going to go there the whole time to study acting to move back to Los Angeles?
Right.
I could have just stayed here and gotten a really good acting class, which is what I did when I was asked to leave the school. I got here.
So when you left school, you still wanted to be an actor.
Yeah, I did. And
that just wasn't the way, Carnegie Mellon.
It wasn't. Do
they use you as one of their alumni now on their Tiny Odd Podcast? There's a picture of Travis and stuff.
But you know what is funny about And it's indicative, I think, of show business in general. You don't have to have graduated Carnegie Mellon. As long as you went there, you're part of the alumni.
Sure.
You're part of the group of the West Coast Drama Clan, I believe is what it's called. And there's meetings and there's people that you can still interact with. And you know what? It is a great school. I was a horrible student. I wasn't ready for what they had to do. And I felt for some reason I had to prove something, which still doesn't make any sense to me. Like, they just had, I think this year is their 100th class that graduated in theater. So when I went there, they'd had 80 classes, you know, it 80 years of teaching people theater. And I'm like, maybe you don't know what you're talking about. No, I don't know what I'm doing. That's why I went there, you know? So,
yeah, but they knew what they were talking about in their way of doing
sure,
it.
Sure.
And that wasn't your way of doing it though. I don't think
at the time it wasn't. I mean, I look back on it and there was some stuff I still go, I would never do. I mean, it's like any art form. You can learn all of the ways that other people did stuff, but you got to find the thing that works for you. You got to find your little pocket of information that makes sense to you. And I found a great acting class that taught me more in, I don't know, the couple of years I went there than I learned in the couple of years I went to
about
that school.
Acting, yeah. and not laundering cod pieces,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well,
because usually I'm not coming down on Carnegie Mellon because I know very very little about their program.
But neither do I.
isn't it that you have to clean cod pieces for a very 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 long time,
yeah.
And then if you're a graduate student and have already paid them $130,000, you may get in a show because the graduate students really are the ones who get in shows, and you know, undergrads just pretty much clean cod pieces and do lighting.
The first 2 years is, hey, why don't you do every horrible job there is? Junior year, if I'd have made it that far, that's when you start to do the studio shows, which are the smaller.
Yeah, the little black box theater stuff.
And then senior year, you did main stage productions as like, you know, not like me, like I do one sword fight with Patrick Wilson and then I leave. Like, there's a lot of people I went to school with who are pretty big deals now that would probably not know who I was. I'm like, don't you remember we fought for a while in the state
right.
The sword? I was the crazy guy. I was the crazy guy with the Helter Skelter. They'd be like, here's a dollar. Leave me alone. You don't really get to act in front of people till the final year is the way it usually seems to go in a lot of the conservatory programs. But I guess because they want you to get good enough. I mean, because those are paying audiences who come to see those shows. I mean, if you're a student, you get to go for free, but a lot of people in those cities are members of that theater and expect to see really great acting. So if you throw 17-year-old me on stage as Mercutio, you're not going to get something great necessarily.
You might get something interesting though, Travis.
It's true. Yeah.
And I mean that seriously. You might get something interesting. You might not get a full cast who has been trained or possibly tamed into repeating what they've been told.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely – I mean, that's very true because there is – just like with a lot of other schools, you go, you know, this is the style of acting we do.
I find that very true, very true. You spend a lot of money on training, and the training boils down to you see him – do it like that.
Yeah. And then also, too, it's like I feel almost every play or show I've ever done, it's like, all right, just forget everything that we've done and just go. Well, then why'd we do all that stuff?
Right.
If I'm supposed to forget about it. But because they don't know what to say to you.
Yeah. And you're paying them $25,000 a year in order to learn something. So they're going to come up with laying on the floor and thinking about stuff or doing something that doesn't mean anything to the actual show that you're doing.
Yeah, but I mean here was what 17-year-old and even 38-year-old me had a problem with. One time in acting class, we played Red Light, Green Light, the same, you know, like, and it was supposed to be like, explore the space. And when they say green light, you know, go and run. When they say red light, try and find a way to get to the other side. Right next to where we did that, we were on like the second or third floor of this building, and below the building was a preschool, and literally the preschool kids were playing Red Light, Green Light while we were exploring this. And I went,
yes.
I don't know if those kids know they're getting a $25,000 a year acting education right now
right.
by playing that game, because we're doing exactly the same thing up here.
Right.
And then after we did that, we were given an orange. And they would say, okay, here's an orange. I want you to just examine the orange. Get to know everything about the orange. This is an hour-long class. Mm-hmm. I ate the orange 10 minutes in because they were like, do whatever you want with the orange. I ate it. And then she's like, now peel the orange. I'm like, ah, well, I did that already. I don't know what to do now. So I had to like – I faked peeled a already peeled orange and acted, you know,
yeah.
tried to hide the fact that I ate my assignment already. So I don't know.
I don't know. The more you talk about that stuff, and I know that that's certainly a way
sure.
to study the theater. But I'm sure also people could say, well, sure, you write Helter Skelter on the wall in fake blood. There's nothing else to do. You're looking at an orange for an hour.
Yeah.
Most of the hour thinking, and this is helping me to actually perform.
I don't know. And then, well, you studied acting as mm-hmm. well, right? I mean, did you have to do any of those?
Of course. I had to do all those things.
Did you ever
and more useless things.
Did you ever have to do the animal project? I feel that's a
acting like an animal?
Well, you go and you are supposed to go observe an animal, usually
of course.
At a zoo,
yep.
and then base a character on the
yes.
traits of that
that's
animal.
That's Stanislavskian.
Yeah.
Yes, I certainly had to do that. I had to act like a color. I had to act like a tree and have everyone guess the
what
type
tree?
Of tree that it was. I had to do myriad useless things that meant nothing to a successful career as an actor.
Yeah, and you've never, ever thought about or done those things since.
Complete and total waste of time and money.
I guess, I mean, is it as an actor, you get to a job and you're like, they hired me for this full job off of doing two pages. I'm just going to have to BS my way through the other seven pages I have to do and hope nobody calls me on it. I'm guessing that's the same thing as being an acting teacher. You're like, oh, they hired me to be an acting teacher. I got two semesters to fill. What if someone's a tree for a couple of those?
It's hard to work as an actor. You're not going to get a lot of work. You're going to have a lot of free time and you're going to be out of money a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that occurs to everyone is to teach acting.
Sure.
So. Come up with some way to fill time and have people pay you. And congratulations. You did it.
What was the point? What was they telling you the point of being a color?
That is why I got into many serious arguments with acting teachers and why they were suggesting that I go. That none of them kicked me out. I was not kicked out. But the question would arise.
I wouldn't kick you out. I'd be like, whatever you want to be.
Well, the question would arise, well, then why are you here?
Yeah, I got that.
And then
one.
The question was to me, well, then why am I here?
Yeah.
Because I, you know, and not, look, I would do, then we do monologues. And by that point, I feel I was pretty good. And I would do a monologue. And the teacher and the class would all, you know, they would have comments about everyone's monologues. And with mine, everyone would be going like, geez, that was pretty good, you know? So I was like, well, what am I learning?
Yeah, well, that was a big thing I had too at Carnegie was they would want us, the students, to critique each other.
Yes.
And I go, okay, I get that. But then the teacher would never say anything.
Right.
And I go,
right.
Look, if I knew everything about acting, I wouldn't have come to an acting class.
At risk of sounding like a complete jerk now, I would never say, but I would think, yeah, Ted, but why am I listening to you? You stink.
Yeah, no.
I just watched your monologue. You're terrible. Like, what do you know about this?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. That would be the thing, too, is you'd be getting feedback from students, and you go, well, I'm not going to take anything. You
exactly.
say, you're terrible.
So the point is you have to sit there and sort of nod.
Mm-hmm.
Not like you agree, but like, I take that critique mm-hmm. into account.
Those are definite words you just said.
Yeah,
I will agree that those are words. Yeah. That was the main.
So our experience in classical acting training, which we've both done, is nearly the same.
Yeah, and then I came out back home and became a clown for a couple of years. So
a literal
worked.
Clown.
A literal clown for a while. Yeah.
When you came out here, what is that? I mean,
well,
how do you become a clown?
Very sadly.
But really, who doesn't become a clown very sadly?
It's true. The number of people I know who went to and completed clown college is kind of staggering. It's
really
it's in the double digits. I have a lot of friends who clown college doesn't exist anymore, by the way. It ended in 1996. It was usually run by the Barnum and Bailey, or it was run by the Barnum and Bailey Circus, and they quickly realized, oh, we're training all these people to be clowns, and then they just go off and do other stuff and don't necessarily stay with us, so they just shut it down. But I knew a lot of people who went to the very final class, and then once you become a clown, you meet a lot of other clowns. And so here's how that happened. I came out here, came back home, was studying acting, and everything I did, even when I was being serious in my acting class, they went, you know, you're really funny, even when, you know, not like you're being sarcastic or something, but you bring something funny even to a serious role. Have you ever thought about doing sketch or stand-up? And I was like, well, yeah, I thought about it. So then I did sketch comedy for a while, and then I met this girl who had a really cute friend who I dated for a while, who was a member of this theater troupe, whose main guy had just gone off to the Barnum and Bailey. He'd just gotten back from being a clown, and he'd decided that every Shakespeare play we're going to do had clowns in it. In fact, the first play I did was called Clowns Labor's Lost, which was Love's Labor's Lost by clowns. So then the next several years of my life was doing clowning stuff and learning clowning stuff, doing tricks and slide tables and stunts. And I even for a small time was in charge of a clown show for children. At one point, the rest of the troupe had gone off to do a show in Australia. I did not go, so I had to run a show in Burbank that kids came to as a clown. And it was surreal. It was a surreal thing. Like, I don't do it anymore. I'm not a clown anymore. But there's a lot of clown makeup within this house if you want to go. Like, I have four or five different clown noses, depending on the clown I was going to be that
Of course,
day.
Depending on your feelings of the day.
Yeah.
Sure.
I would be an Auguste clown. I would be a full white-faced clown. You know, I had different clowns that I could be. I knew balloon tricks. The whole thing. So the way that you get it to be a clown is you just meet other clowns.
Isn't that interesting? Because, I mean, it really is true that people who aren't involved in show business don't know. But when you're young and you're going around to all different kinds of shows and you have this energy inside of you that's just to get up on stage, you end up meeting a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And I knew a very close friend of mine from high school, went to the Commedia dell'Arte school
in
Arcata,
yeah.
California, which is a sort of a type of clowning and theater and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, it's in my book, but I almost went off and did a whole thing, you know, in Europe myself.
Really?
Not specific clowning, but kind of a, you know, a commedia and mime and, you know, sort of juggling in theater thing. You know, and that was the decision. Go there or move to California.
Yeah. You made the right choice.
I just think, you know, because casting people in New York, that wasn't working out for me. But they were saying, why don't you move to California? Because you're just big. You look like a big kind of farm boy from Nebraska. And no plays are casting. We don't have the roles.
Right.
So, you know, you're good. Go out there and, you know, get on
Knock 'em dead.
Dukes of Hazzard or drive the General Lee around. I don't know.
Get on Knight Rider if you can.
Yes.
There's going to be this kid you're going to meet.
Do
He'll
lemonade commercials or something. I don't know, something. So you end up following that. But when did clowning just stop or it just dwindled to nothing?
It just got – well, no. I mean the troupe is still around. They're a really great troupe. They're one of the more popular troupes of – comedic actors and performing. They don't just do clowning stuff. They do have a specific clown show. I don't know how often they do it anymore, but the main thing that they do now is, and kind of was from the get-go, is they take a Shakespeare show and they not update it, but they add a modern element to
it. This is Troubadour Theater.
Troubadour,
yes.
Troubadour
it's a
company.
Very famous theater company within LA who do kind of lampooning of Shakespeare plays.
Yeah, and they mix it with music of popular act, like we did Fleetwood Macbeth. We did the comedy of Aerosmith. We did then we also do Christmas shows, you know, what was the Stevie Wonderful Life, A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, these are very popular shows.
Yeah, and I was
here.
And all of those that I listed I have been in. And but what was always fun, I don't know if it just speaks to me as a chameleon, as an actor, people would be like, oh, I loved that show. Actually, one time, the Fleetwood Macbeth thing. There were several guys who ended up playing the king in Macbeth, and I was one of them. And I was talking to one of the band members, and he was like, you know, the second guy who played the king, he was okay, but the first guy was the best. I was the second guy. And so I'm going, oh, really? And I thought he was messing with me. I was like, oh, so what? Well, I mean, the second guy was okay. I mean, he was funny, but that first guy, oh, he just nailed it. And the second guy just never really got to where that first guy was. And I was like, really? You know, I was the second guy. He was like, oh, man, you were great. Yeah. So yeah, a lot of the times I've been in these shows and people don't know. I mean, part of my bio was for a while, like, I'm in that show you didn't know I was in. You mm-hmm. know, like, that was, I was in that. So
from there, well, let's. I don't want to take too much of your time, Trevor. Oh. But from there, when does it occur to you? I'm getting into the ring with Dad's thing. You know, I'm doing straight up stand up. I'm going to start writing jokes and going out to the open mic in a different way. And they say, Travis Clark, and you come out and, you know, grab the mic. Hey, how's everybody doing?
When you go, you know, I have to rely on other people for me to do acting. I have to, even if it's a play I produce myself, I got to rely on a place to be, other actors, stuff like that. And there's a finite amount of times you can do it. Stand up, I can do 7 nights a week, several times a night, depending on how industrious I want to be. And it relies on me and me generating material that I think is interesting. And I can go do it as much as I want and pursue that. And plus two, it's like I was saying, like, I don't need to be recognized. Like, I don't want people to be like, oh, that's Travis Clark. He's amazing. That'd be great. But to sit there and you put several years into like being part of a troupe and you go, people don't even know I'm in this. But when I get on stage, if I do well or I don't do well, I'm the only one accountable
right.
for
that
it.
That was yeah. the thing that I did. I made that thing. You know, yeah. I wrote it and performed it, and that's what it was.
Yeah. So if you hated it, then you hate me, or you hate what I did. If you liked it, you know, you like that is mine. That is something I did. And truthfully, I feel like I should have been doing this years ago. It's really, it's not like, you know, oh, and the crowd parted and it's just nothing but joy and harps all the time. Yeah. There's sometimes I'm like, why am I doing this?
Was there reticence about doing it when Dad had done so many, you know, HBO specials, yeah. many, you know, more Tonight shows than you can, all of that kind of thing. And, but fortunately, and the world of stand-up is far different now. And
sure.
I'm sure you don't get a lot of that, oh, Blake's son.
Not a lot of people know. I mean, some people do. I'm not embarrassed about it. I don't not talk about it, but I also don't make a point to mention it every chance I get. But at the same time, I mean, when I first seriously started considering it, I went to my dad and I said, Dad, I'm really thinking about doing stand-up and, you know, anything you could tell me that would help me. Do you have any advice? And he went, yeah, don't. Like that was it.
Really?
Yeah.
You come to Dad, you go, oh, man, that's a big mistake. Don't go near that, man.
And you know, and I have passed on that information to people, because if you don't have a burning desire to be on stage doing it, don't do it.
Well, I think Dad was right, because that's I think what he was saying.
Yes.
Is yeah. no matter what I say, it doesn't matter what I say. If yeah. you have to do it, you're going to do it anyway.
Right.
And if you don't have the perseverance, if you don't have the fire in your belly to stay in it when everything looks terrible and like you're a failure, well, then you're going to fail anyway.
Sure.
So it doesn't matter what I say. You're going to either do it or not do it.
I mean, I meet people all the time who are like, oh, yeah, well, I want to direct and I want to do this and I want to do that. Then go do those things. Don't do this thing. If this isn't something that you're up at late at night, like, oh my God, I just thought of the best wording for this joke. Don't right. do it. Or do it as a hobby, but don't pursue it. You know, I was out till 2 o'clock last night, performed for 3 people, but I loved it. I mean, I would love it if there were 30 people, that would have been better.
Right.
But I genuinely enjoy getting to get on stage and try and make somebody laugh. That is fun for me. And whether it's 3 people or 300 people, I try and, you know, with 3 people, it's a lot easier. You go, okay, what are you into? What are you into? Okay, I'll do a joke for each of you, and then you each have a little moment, you know. But it's, and I feel I have the, not an advantage, but I have a privileged upbringing that I got to grow up around so many great comics. Like I knew you when I was a little kid. I saw you perform with when you still played the tuba. Like
That was a long time ago.
I remember that very clearly. Yeah. I remember all of that. I remember when you and Dice at lived in Yakov's house. Like I remember.
Hey,
that.
It wasn't Yakov's house.
It wasn't?
No, Yakov rented it too. We lived together. Me and Yakov and Andrew Dice Clay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember you had just had some new headshot put up and everybody was giving you grief about it. It was taped to your door.
They taped it to my door and they put like sunglasses on it and everything. And they said I should change my name because it was one of those, you know, you're a very young guy and somehow you get the macho dude headshot.
Right. And I think they wanted your name to be Joe Cool or something like that, right? It was some kind
of... I'll tell you. It was Dirk Savage. Dirk Savage was my new stage name. Because I had a kind of a Dirk Savage sort of headshot.
You did. You had like a leather jacket on, didn't you?
Something like that. People have a headshot and you go to a photographer and you go, I have a couple of headshots actually with the collar up. And that was the thing where I felt like I was having an argument with the photographer. And he's going, well, no, I think it looks good. I'm like, we'll just do a few options with the polo shirt, with the polo shirt collar up and the jacket collar up. And I still have them at my house. I mean, I have the proofs from the session and everything. I never sent that out as my headshot, but that was a good lesson. That was an expensive lesson. And you go home and you think, don't listen to photographers anymore. Yeah. It's just, I'm paying him. It'll just be what I want it to be. No Dirk Savage shots, no collar up shots.
I mean, I have the same thing too. Like right now I have really long hair and a really long beard. And
you are going Z because you've always been bearded.
Yeah.
You've always been sort of done as in adulthood, the Grizzly Adams sort of thing.
Right.
But it's looking like you're thinking, hey, maybe ZZ Top.
Or Sons of Anarchy.
I'm thinking
really, really gunning for Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're going like long beard, long hair.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think it might be time. My current thing I say, and this is really silly, is I'm considering a shave and a haircut, but it would literally cost me 2 bits. Like, because I have, that's all I talk about.
I have long hair and a beard.
And that's like at least 2 5-minute chunks I will lose if I do. But
you mean two comedy bits.
Yeah. So I am getting ready to take new headshots and I'm like, you know, I have a really full beard now and really long hair. And they're like, yeah, go ahead and take photos. And then I know the second I take them, I'll be like, what if you cut your hair and like, you know, kind of like shave your, I'm like, cause it's happened to me so many times where like I had really long hair before, took great shots and they went, you should have shorter hair. I'm like, but we could have done that before and it wouldn't have cost me $400 to get another haircut and more.
So you do it over 2 days. You just tell the photographer, we're going to do bearded and everything. Then I'm getting a haircut that evening. And then we come back and do the shots.
We'll do a pickup shot. Yeah. You know, that is a great idea. That is exactly what I'm going to do.
How long have you had your beard now?
This is a week away from being a yeared. A yeared is where you let your beard grow for a year.
Oh, okay.
That is actually a thing people say.
And before that, you didn't have a beard at all?
I've had several beards.
Yeah.
And then I usually around the 4 or 5 month mark, go, I can't do this anymore, and shave it off.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
I mean, especially now with it being hot, I'm like, I really don't want a face sweater anymore. I'm really over it. And right now, too, like it's got some length to it, and I like it. But at the same time, I go, I'm really tired of people going, you know, you have
something in your child's tricycle. There's a small, I think somebody's Nerf ball is stuck in your.
Kids are often losing their toys in my face.
Yeah. So day to day, what's Travis doing? You are pursuing an acting career with your beard.
Yeah, with me and my beard together, we're a package.
Are you still doing troubadour shows? Are you still doing theater?
I haven't done them in a while. Mm-hmm. Part of that was my back was messed up and I just couldn't do it. And then other part is like, if I were to go do one of those shows, that's a minimum of 3 months I'm giving up doing stand-up.
I know. You know? It's so what people, professional actors, are in a bind.
Yeah.
Because you get a play. Of course, you want to do a play.
Sure.
Plays are wonderful and everything, but you're going broke. They just, you're in a play. And making very little. If you make money, you're making very little. Usually you're making nothing. And you, and the play will ask, hey, if some jobs come up, we'd really like you to just be committed to this play. Well, no.
Right. And, you know, Troubadour pays, they do pay. Uh-huh. And it's again, a lot of my friends are in that troupe. It's a great troupe, but it's just, I have.
Well, you're pursuing the stand-up right now.
And I have 14 years of being in that troupe.
Yeah.
And there's a great 14 years, but I feel I need to kind of go, what's just me? You know, what else can I do? You know?
And how is the stand-up going? How many sets are you doing a week?
Oh,
a lot. You're all
minimum.
All the time?
I'd say a minimum of 10, but I try for 14. I try for
14.
I try for two a day.
Two a night.
Yeah. I try. Sometimes I can do more. Sometimes I do less.
Well, that's how to do it. As you know, as your dad would say, as I would say to people when they say, well, how do you, well, you just do it.
You go and you keep
going and going and going and doing it and doing it and doing it. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, there was a period in there, I think about at least 10 years, at least, if not more, probably 12, where I was, every night, numerous sets, at least two.
And then,
sometimes the Comedy Store had the Westwood Comedy Store and Hollywood.
Oh, right.
And you would do a set in Hollywood. I would drive, because your dad and I were the security guys and everything. I would do a set in Hollywood, tell your dad, hey, I'll be back to lock up later, but I have a spot in Westwood. Go across town all the way to Westwood, get out, do a set there, drive all the way back to Hollywood, and kick out three drunks and lock up the place.
Yeah. Well, what's fun now in the, I hate saying the word alternative, but in the alternative comedy scene is comedy is anywhere you want it to be. And a couple of friends of mine do this thing called a hike mic, where you go and you pick a place that would just be cool to have photos doing comedy at, and you hike up to it. We did it at the Hollywood sign a couple of times. Just last weekend, we did it at the Bat Cave, the original 1966 Bat Cave.
Uh-huh.
So we bring a little amp, we bring a microphone, and anybody who wants to come along and anybody who's in the area will hear, you know, half a dozen to a dozen comics do 3 to 5 minutes in the wilderness, you know, and
wow.
And it's just fun. It's just, you know, that's what I enjoy about comedy is.
I'm really loving those shows. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. You go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
It's the camaraderie. Like you find your comedy family, you know, which maybe I guess you find that in acting too, but it's more solipsistic, I think, with comedy. It's a singular person kind of thing. So when you find those other people that you gravitate towards, you get to have fun with them both on and off stage.
I think there are a lot of fun shows. Yeah. I just did a show, Comedy Living Room, at
a house. Oh, those are cool shows. Yeah.
A house in Hollywood. It's just a house.
Yeah.
And you go there and I'm thinking, well, sure. Why not? Just for fun. I'll see. And the place is packed.
Yeah, packed
up. The backyard is packed with people.
People peering in the window.
Exactly. Everything. Yeah. It was a great fun show or Meltdown show that you know about.
Sure.
There at Meltdown Comics in Hollywood. But there's a lot going on. How I got to let you go because we're there now.
Okay.
But how can people find you on the interwebs?
On the internet, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at That Guy Travis. And I'm always posting
That
about,
Guy Travis and Facebook. And do you announce shows?
Yeah,
on
the
Twitter?
Time. On Twitter and on Facebook, yeah. And at some point I'll have an actual Travis Clark website, but at the moment I don't because
I like your YouTube videos.
Oh, the all two I have?
Yeah, I like both of them. Weren't you in more than, I thought I watched more than that.
Maybe,
yeah.
I don't remember what I put up anymore.
Maybe Flappers has one or somebody. One of those clubs put you up.
I'm still waiting to get TravisClark.com from a guy who mows lawns in Texas. He does not want to release that. So you go to TravisClark.com, it'll immediately redirect you to lawnsoftexas.com. But Travis Clark.
And it redirects you to Lawns of Texas because he had Travis Clark, but he made Lawns of Texas. And it's just a steering.
Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I will buy this off of you. And he's like, nope. No, thank you. I want to keep it. So at some point there'll be a Travis Clark, probably Travis Clark comedy or something. I don't know. We'll see.
TravisClark.biz.
Oh, because that's just
.org. TravisClark.edu.
Yeah. If nothing else, it's an educational site of what not to do.
Well, Travis, you are really one of my highlights of my time at the Comedy Store. Because when you would come there, it was just so great. I mean, I liked you. You were a great kid. And to see you come up like this and express yourself, like, I like the guy that painted on the walls at Carnegie Mellon, you know? in that way of, I don't know. I just, we connected. We were buddies back at the Comedy Store. I thought a lot of you then. I'm glad you've come up and followed your dad, but in your own way, you know, with your own stuff to say, your own experiences, man. I just think it's terrific. Thanks for, you know, being on.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is a highlight here, getting to hang out and talk with you. I mean, you're one of my favorite people. So
thanks, buddy. And Tiny Odd Conversations. We have to say that.
Oh, yeah. That's my podcast I do with my wife, where if you want to hear what divorce sounds like in slow motion, listen to Tiny Odd Conversations.
Tiny Odd Conversations on iTunes and everything.
All of those places.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
People come up to me all over the country saying, my son, he wants to get involved in that show biz, but I know it's all drugs and it's all bad, horrible people, and I don't want him to do it. So what would you say to him? I would say listen to Travis Clark and listen to a lot of young people who have practiced, who have studied, and who take this art form seriously, and then I would say go for it. Unless you want to be a big shot or you have a hole in yourself that you think showbiz is going to fill, in which case, yes, you're going to get upset and you're going to spit out and go into the stands. But isn't Travis great? Thanks for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thank you very much. Hey, would you subscribe to the podcast or tell a friend about it or tweet about it or Facebook about it or do, I don't know what people, do something about it. Hey, with all of the issues in your life, how about that? Do something about it. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.